Hello and welcome to Roll With The Punches. This is episode number 229 and I'm your host, Tiff Cook. If you're a Roll With The Punches regular, you will be no stranger whatsoever to hearing me talk about recently watching the Filthy Rich and Homeless series, where a handful of Australia's wealthy humans were plucked from the comfort of their luxurious lives and immersed in a 10-day experience of sleeping rough. Today's guest is Tim Guest, self-made millionaire and retiree at 27, and my favourite participant from series one of the documentary. Hey, thank you so much for tuning in, sharing the episodes with your friends, and for leaving five-star ratings and reviews. There have been so many new listeners lately, and it feels so amazing hearing the feedback and knowing that we are reaching new ears. If hearing about the effects of homelessness touches your heart the way that it did mine, then reach out to my favourite organisation, Bed Down. Norm McGillivray shared his touching story in episode 183. If you haven't heard it, go and head over after this and have a listen. I am so keen to help his amazing cause as much as possible. So check it out at www.beddown.org.au. Tim Guest, my new guest on Roll With The Punches, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
I'm so excited to talk to you. I'm so excited. Yeah. And I'm just going to tell my audience, what did you say to me just before when we were having a pre-podcast chat?
I'm not sure which bit we were talking about.
I know, we talked about a lot. You just congratulated me. Yes, and I was like, have a go at this superstar that's like achieved so much. I was reading your bio before and I was like, you're pretty amazing. And you were just like, yeah, congratulations. And I was like, oh, thanks.
Oh, what you've done is amazing.
Thank you so much.
Starting, it's incredible.
Boom. Well, luckily this will have roughly a 1 week delay on airing because I haven't announced that publicly yet. Because that is literally in the being finalized stages. And guess what, Tim? I am so terrible at keeping secrets. And look, if you follow my Facebook, I am just, you know, every move I make, every moment, if there's something that excites me, everyone bloody knows about it. Like, I was so excited yesterday because I was working on two things. One was a workshop that I'm putting together and I'm super excited about that. And the other one was, and the podcast listeners, like I've just had this peak in listeners coming onto the podcast. So the numbers were going well. I was organizing this and I was planning this thing and it was just, my dopamine was just like flowing out of my head, bouncing off the walls. I was sick of myself. I reckon I did 1,000 posts yesterday of overexcited ramblings to the world.
Well, here's what I like. You wear your heart on your sleeve, right?
I sure do. I sure do.
Me too.
Anyway, so I was told recently, had a really amazing guest on my show, Norm McGillivray, episode 183. I now support his organisation and he supports the podcast because he's amazing. And after expressing how amazing I thought he was, one of my listeners messaged me and said, have you watched Filthy Rich and Homeless? And I was like, no, I don't ever watch TV. Not one to watch TV. Yeah. I might start as of next week. at least half an hour a week. Yeah. But I managed to find some time to throw myself on the couch and I tell you what, I just powered through that series and I absolutely loved it. And I was like, I've got to talk to this Tim guy. I've got to talk to you. That was 2017, right?
So I think the filming was actually 2016. It's a while back now. So, no, maybe it was 2017, the filming. I apologise. I can't remember which year it was that it came out. But, yeah, the filming was done August in the year before and then I think it was launched in June of the following year.
Yeah. How'd it come about that you wound up on the show and what was your expectation? What was your interest?
Yeah, so, it started, I do a little bit of media stuff, you know, mainly around obviously finance and investment, things like that. Yeah. And a friend of mine who worked in media here in Perth, she's, you know, very much in the industry. She's a TV presenter, she, you know, things like that. She must have spoken with someone who was doing the casting for the show. So I think looking over here in Perth, they had, you know, an outside contractor that was doing it for them. And she just reached out to me and said, look, I spoke to this girl. And, you know, she explained to me what the project was. And I just immediately thought of you. I thought you would be just amazing for this. And would I be willing to talk to someone about it? And I said, yeah, sure, I'd be willing to talk about it. And from there, they arranged, well, you do a couple of kind of, there's like a pre-casting interview or something that's fairly short, Zoom or something like that. Mm. And then they did something that was a bit more, you know, kind of one-on-one, but being filmed interview, you know, asking me my perspectives and my thoughts and you know, I'm guessing, but I think the thing that they liked about me was my willingness to kind of, you know, rather than just, I guess, say an answer, you know, like, you know, if someone just asked me off the top of their head, you know, what do I think of homeless people, my immediate answer might be something a bit diplomatic or a bit, you know, like, I don't know, like, you know, like what we are as human beings, you know, we often, you know, we want to look good more than really kind of tell the truth most of the time.
Yeah.
And I kind of just paused for a second and said, all right, well, hang on, what are the thoughts that sometimes run through my head when I've, you know, seen or experienced homeless people? And, you know, not too long ago, I'd kind of been verbally abused, threatened at a park. We had a park not far from the office where a lot of homeless people resided. We'd actually put on meals with one of the local organisations there for Easter before. And I just was honest, you know, sometimes I think things like, you know, come on, mate, why don't you just, you know, get off your ass and sort your life out, get off the drug, you know, because that's, you know, that's the thoughts that I have, you know, I think probably many of us have, and I don't know, I just tried to generate the courage to be honest about them.
I loved it. And what I think I loved most is it also ignited in me, that there's a very big version of the same thing happening with me. Like, they frighten me. It would frighten me to often walk past them. But also, I mean, I just told you about this whole, the whole podcast and how that came about. And as I watched that film, I went, well, even I'm privileged. Like, I've put a lot of hard work into this. I had to get off my ass when times were tough and do it. No one did it for me. And I've worked, could vomit at the amount of hours I've put into this, really. But I also went, yeah, but I've got family that love me and I've got a healthy body and mind and I've had all this experience and support and I've got access to resources. I was like, well, that's privilege in itself. And it just made me also turn that perspective inward.
Mm.
And I just found that really powerful. And that was just from hearing you unfiltered. And then watching you go through what you went through.
No, thanks. I've done a lot of work in the past with charities and things like that. And, you know, I'm, if I'm just frank, I mean, I can be arrogant. I've got a big ego. I can, you know, get stuck in things and not care about people enough. But, you know, but there's that also that other side of me that does care about people. And I've always tried to balance my drivenness. Because I think that's actually one of the things that I experienced financially with the success that I had probably relatively young, kind of getting to a point where realizing I had this success, but I wasn't any more satisfied or fulfilled, or, you know, that emptiness inside of me that had kind of driven my desire for that sex was still present. And, you know, I was lucky, you know, where, you know, I did have the resources, you know, I had time, I had money where, you know, I could spend some time doing some reflection and, you know, consideration about my life and a little bit of self-discovery as well. And, you know, I was, you know, through guidance, through some mentors and programs that I did, I was able to really see that, you know, the thing that I've always really cared about, you know, even when I was being successful, really the passion that was underneath it was helping people or wanting to contribute or just wanting to feel like I'd made a mark on this world, you know. And so, you know, when I'd got back into the workforce and restarted my businesses to kind of help people do what I'd done, I really wanted that contribution to be a big part of it. Actually two things. I wanted my name to be very heavily attached to it, not for my ego, for actually the threat that it was to my ego. Like, I better make sure it fulfills on what I say it does because my name's at risk. You know, so that was like a self-accountability thing, right? Knowing that, you know, I can take my foot off the gas. I can take credit and, you know, and that's where my self-sabotage thing sometimes kicks in, is where I take credit, take my foot off the gas and things can collapse, right?
Yeah.
So I have my name on it so that would help hold myself accountable. But then also, you know, something that we did, well, I did from the founding of the company was made sure that we donated 10% of our profits to charity or community projects, you know, because I wanted to make sure that I was always staying connected to what I was passionate about and giving back. And then extending that by, you know, I tried to do something a year that would level me, you know, something that would, you know, and it, things like climbed Mount Kilimanjaro to raise funds. There was a group of eight of us that did that to raise funds for suicide prevention. You know, I've started a suicide prevention campaign, you know, going and working at an orphanage in Vietnam for a week. Just always doing something like that at least once a year to kind of slap me around a bit, you know, and you know, make me remember that, okay, if my phone's on 10%, that's not really such a big freaking deal. You know, there's people in this world that, reverting to the orphanages in Kenya and Vietnam that I've had the short privilege of working in, like those kids own not a single thing. Not a single thing. And yet they're also some of the happiest people I've ever met in my life as well, you know. Sorry, that was kind of a bit of a long-winded answer, but you know, when I went into the project, I had this kind of real commitment. In fact, have you ever heard of a documentary filmmaker called Louis Theroux?
Louis Theroux, it sounds familiar.
Well, British guy, big glasses, bit of a geeky kind of looking guy. He's done stuff where he's done documentary. He'll spend like with swingers or with like some of the most conservative churches in the US or
ringing a bell. It's definitely ringing a bell.
Look, the thing that I always loved about him was when he would go into those scenarios, he would always ask the questions that for him were there, but try not to censor himself. Like try not to not ask a question because he might be scared of the answer or how he might look. Just straight up ask. And I really wanted to bring that to my experience in the documentary and just try and be as, you know, I was there for 10 days, try and be as real as I possibly could and, you know, be as vulnerable as well and you know, just share my experiences with the people that I had, you know, spent my time with and the people watching at home.
Yeah. In terms of your expectations versus your experience, was there much of a difference?
To some extent, you didn't really have too many expectations because they didn't tell you what you were doing. All they would say is that it was a 10-day immersive experience around the issue of homelessness. Now, I guessed that probably what we were going to be doing is spending 10 days living on the streets or something along those lines. But then when I rocked up and, you know, some of the other participants, you know, Christian's, you know, his dad, obviously, Richard Wilkins, you know, been around TV for a long time. And he was like, oh, no, there's no way they're going to do that. They wouldn't be able to get the insurance for it. And, you know, I'm like, oh, okay, all right, well, you know, but then, you know, the next day they basically took us around in a Tarago or something like that and dropped us off in different states of the city. And I was like, all right, this is what we're doing.
Is it terrifying?
Look, it's so many things. It's complex. There were certainly times where I was very, you know, quite scared. I think on the first night, the second night, I tried to make my way to a late night cafe that was run by the Salvation Army that was open from 11 till 6 in the morning.
Yeah.
And pretty much when we got there, I think what was happening was another one of the participants was in there. So they were preventing, they wanted to keep us apart, separated. So, you know, if I was kind of heading in a direction sometime and someone was down that direction, which, you know, might only rarely happen, they would kind of try and, you know, tell us to wait or send us in another direction. But, you know, I mean, it was just, that was a highly volatile situation. You know, late at night, a lot of people are drug or alcohol affected. And people are carrying weapons. You know, they're scared for their own safety as well, you know. You know, it's just, it's like a powder keg. It can escalate very quickly. And you know, while we did, so, you know, we had like a camera operator, an audio operator, sometimes a third person as like a director or a producer or something like that. But then you'd have one security person. But that would be for the whole group. And you're not necessarily together. Like, you know, they might be on the other side of the road filming me, or sometimes I go places they can't. Like, the first night I slept in a construction site. They couldn't go in there. It was illegal for them to go in there, you know. Yeah, you know, there's some times where you were terrified, but then there was experiences like I didn't feel worried at night sleeping because, you know, other homeless people, well, they got to be worried about their stuff. I didn't have to. I got a security guy that was keeping an eye out for me. So, but, you know, I guess the things that I did go through were things like, I mean, firstly, there was the physical impact of doing what I was doing. I mean, it was middle of winter, record rainfall, It was super cold. You're sleeping on concrete, carrying your stuff everywhere. You know, it's like I'd get really stiff and sore in my hips and my back. And, you know, so that was tough, right? Mm-hmm. And then there's also like the mental impact, you know, things that you wouldn't normally consider. Like, you know, I'd wake up in the morning on one of the streets there in the center of Melbourne. And, you know, you'd probably wake up because there's a street sweeper or a garbage truck going by, but you don't know what time it is. You've got your watch. Now, here's the other thing. You don't know what, you know that the church that serves breakfast opens between 9 and 9.30, right? So it's like, hang on, what time? Do I need to get up? Do I need to be like, so there's this kind of, like there's this threat that's present, like in the background, like I'm not sure if I should be somewhere. Like, do I go and check? Do I, or should I still be sleeping because, you know, I've got to get another hour worth of sleep or, you know, so there's that impact. And then, you know, the other impact that I felt was the impact of spending time with participants. You know, I'm going to get emotional about it, even though it's, you know, such a long time ago. Just, you know, it's so easy when you're walking through the city and you're on your phone and, you know, you're charging somewhere and a homeless person kind of steps out and wants to ask you for change or something like that. It's easy to just walk by, you know, it's easy to be busy in that moment and ignore them. But, you know, you spend time having breakfast with them and, you know, Bellatrix will, I'll never forget, this transgender woman. You know, some people don't want to be near the camera, right? They're going through the toughest period of their life. Other people, maybe they kind of like the opportunity of being on camera. You know, so Bellatrix come and spoke to me and, you know, she was just so open about, you know, doing drugs the night before and, you know, her journey. I mean, it all started with her, you know, mum was giving her drugs from the age of two, like my daughter's age. You know, and you know, this is where maybe my perspective differs from some people, because I know some people talk about homelessness like, you know what, Tiff, you know, it could happen to you. Like tomorrow you could lose everything, right? Like, or, you know, and look, I'm certainly not saying that that's not a possibility, but I also don't think that that's really, you're not a, I don't want to speak too much about you, right? Because I don't know you too much. But the people who are most vulnerable are people who have had extensive trauma throughout their childhoods.
Yes.
You know, like even biologically, and I'm not a doctor, but I can imagine that their brains probably even haven't had the chances to form properly. You know, what chances have they got? You know, and these are, you know, kids like my daughter's age or kids like the age of my nephew. So, you know, like 8 and 10, you know, dealing with, you know, sexual abuse in the home, domestic violence. You know, domestic violence is the biggest issue leading to homelessness. You know, it's, you know, we worry about, I don't know, whether we're going to, I don't know, how we're doing at our job or, you know, we're our partners or, you know, and that's what it was really hard for me, you know, spending time with these people and getting to know them and, you know, it being able to penetrate that wall that I maybe have that keeps people at a distance enough when I'm busy or when I'm focused on my stuff. You know, we all got to survive in life and we're all dealing with our stuff, right? And I don't think anyone should feel guilty or bad about that, you know, but we can also pause and, you know, look at the other side. And, you know, when I did spend time with some of those people, you know, they were people just like people that I love and care about who have, you know, really don't even have a chance because of the environments that they were in. You know, for me, it created a much more complex issue because, you know, it would be easy to say that more public housing would solve this issue. You know, it'd be easy if we said money, right, or something like that. But I think that's complete bullshit. This is a societal issue. This is an issue about how you and me treat each other as human beings. And, you know, I don't think it's anything to get moral about either because, you know, there's parts of us human beings that we don't understand very well. Like we're a biological creature.
Yeah.
You know, and most of what we do as human beings, in fact, there's, you know, cutting edge research nowadays that believe things like free will don't even exist. Like that we're operating on automatic 99% of the time.
Yep.
And it is hard for us to resist those kind of reactions. But we do human things to people. You know, we make each other wrong. We'll do stuff to win. You know, we'll dominate each other to protect ourselves, to keep each other at bay. We'll invalidate other people. We'll, you know, it's you know, I mean, my wife might, you know, snap at me about something, knowing full well I should have done something. And in a moment I might snap back and, oh, like, make it her fault. You know, it's just in a moment, right? Like,
yeah.
But that's just what it is to be human. And, you know, I think understanding and, oh, we're going into some existential chat right now, right? But I don't know. I just think if we gave ourselves a little bit of space, weren't so hard on ourselves and approached us from that perspective, we might have a little bit more space for ourselves and a little bit more space for other people being human beings and then really support each other.
Yeah, I agree. I wholeheartedly agree with you on the enormity and the complexity of the issue. I think of, so I watched The Wisdom of Trauma. I've had so many trauma conversations on this podcast and about my own stuff that came up through starting this podcast and actually opening the door on it. And so I watched The Wisdom of Trauma by Gabor Maté, Dr. Gabor Maté, whose name's pretty big in the trauma space. And I reached out to a lady called Fritzi Horstmann. She was on the show.
I love her name. What a name.
Oh, I know, right? I had, as you can imagine, I couldn't bloody say it on the podcast. Hell of a time trying to pronounce it. But she's brilliant, right? So she's a US lady. She goes into some of the hardest prisons in the US and she rolls out these programs on based around the adverse childhood experience score. So I don't know if you've heard of that term, adverse childhood experience. It's a score. You can jump on the internet and go and find out your score on it. And basically it's You stacking however many adverse childhood experiences, you know, it could be drugs, could be violence, it could be sexual abuse. And however, whatever your rating is, the higher the rating, the obviously the worse the mental health impacts. Everyone in the criminal justice system has this experience. So her idea, and I believe it to be true, is that the criminal justice system is treating trauma with trauma. So you've got these traumatized people. Like people, I think people are born and they're not born with bad personalities. They're not born to be bad people, but through the conditioning and the things that have emotionally, you know, broken us, we grow up, we become an adult, we have no idea what's going on, and then we reproduce and then we pass on these shitty situations. And it kind of just evolves like that. Mm. Just like you were saying, you know, you have drugs and addiction and violence, and then a child brought up in that environment, then they don't have the skills or the neurochemistry to even understand and comprehend that. And then we have this criminal justice system that throws people in. It isolates them. It further abuses them. It bullies them. And then we think that after 10 years of that, they're going to come out healed and they're going to come out and be a good person.
And then, of course, you've also got the added complexity as well, like throwing out, you know, a lot around our drug laws. You know, you've got a lot of non-violent offenders, you know, people who, that, you know, I mean, I'm not going to be the judge, right? I don't know the answers, but, you know, there's a strong argument for maybe that jail is not the right place for them to be, you know, and, you know, further exacerbating the exact problem that you're talking about.
Yeah, 100%.
There's got to be a balance. Like, of course, you know, we need to hold people responsible for their actions, right? But, you know, there's obviously so much more to it than that. And you know, I must admit, I don't understand a lot about trauma, right? That's certainly not an area that I've explored a lot about. But I have for a long time been very interested on, well, let me give you a scenario, right? You know, like you could have a person in life who loses both their legs, who says that I am, you know, to themselves that I'm less of a person. You know, and then goes on to live a life of depression, you know, and not a great life, you know. But at the same time, you can also have a person that loses both legs and says, I'm no less of a person. And they go on to live a fulfilling, satisfying, contributive life. How can we, I guess, the distinction between those two, how can we provide people in society with more education on that? You know, I mean, getting back to the homeless thing, I mean, you know, we go to school and we learn things like geography and social studies and maths, and, you know, I'm not at all invalidating those things, but you know, where in life do we go to learn how to have healthy relationships? You know, where in life do we go to learn how to deal with conflict? You know, where in life do we go to learn how to deal with these failures in life and not have them, you know, I mean, sorry, going off on another little tangent. But, you know,
I love it. I love it.
The work I've kind of done around that little voice we have in our head. You know, and I think one of the most limiting things that people believe is that that little voice is them.
Yes.
It's not you. It's just a little voice. We've all got it. And listen to how it speaks to you, for crying out loud. You know, yeah. It's a freaking mental patient. It's, you know, I mean, it's the little voice that'll tell me, you know, back in my single days to, you know, you can do this, go and talk to a girl. And then you go and talk to a girl and it's a little voice that then tells, oh, you moron, you idiot. You know, like, you absolute dickhead. Why would you do those things, you know? And just how much it rules our life, you know. And you know, I don't know that this is the connection, but, you know, the person that does lose both their legs, if they're not, they haven't got access to being able to distinguish that whatever that little voice is telling you, it's just a little voice. You know, it's not you and it's not the truth, you know. And I think even just some simple things like that can give people a lot of freedom. I mean, man, we are so hard on ourselves.
I've had so many, obviously so many people on this show that are, I mean, this is episode 220 something, probably 230 by the time we get there. So I've had hundreds of conversations, and one in particular I remember because I got, well, I get goosebumps all the time because I get a bit excited, as you can well see. But there was Josh Coman was one of my earlier conversations. He's a guy from New Zealand, 2 or 3-time leukemia survivor. He also has, I'll say this backwards, I can't remember if it's graft versus host or host versus graft disease, which is basically where your immune system turns against you. Like, so his skin's patchy, he's, you know, he's got grey eyebrows, like his immune system is attacking him. And he nearly died a bunch of times, and he travelled to Victoria and he was at this men's camp, and then he ended up having multiple heart attacks and getting wheeled off to hospital. And, you know, all the men there were just like, oh, Josh, you know, he's here for this and this is so shit. He's a young guy. Tells me this story. He's on a plane coming to from New Zealand to Melbourne to have this new treatment. And he goes, I was sitting on the plane next to this really pretty girl, and in a moment of, you know, that little voice being on his side, he was like, oh, starts to chat to her, you know, how are you? She goes, oh, what are you going to Melbourne for? And he says, going to visit his brother. I didn't want to tell her really why. And he goes, what do you, you know, what do you do? And she said, I'm an oncology nurse. And he was like, oh. So he ended up telling her, you know, I'm going over for this new treatment. She'd never heard of it. He goes, do you want to come and check it out, right? They just got married. They just So they just got married. But also, goosebumps, see, there they are, got them. His story about finding faith, healing his relationship with his dad, I just sat and listened to him and looked at the energy in him, and I just said, this sounds weird to say and it feels weird to say, but I feel like your life is so much better because of what you've been through with this illness, because of it. I feel like if you didn't have that, the depth of what you right now have just wouldn't be there.
Totally. And I mean, I don't know that I know, I mean, I know plenty of stories of people that have dealt with, you know, some plenty of horrible stuff, but I think for the most part, for most of us, like, I think you got to live like that.
Yeah.
So much of what we're dealt in life, we have little to no control over.
Yeah.
If you can't find the joy or the gratitude in it, then, well, it's probably just not going to be as much fun.
Yeah.
I mean, probably worse than not much fun, right? It's probably going to be a struggle, frustration, depression. So, yeah, but like I said, it's easy for me to say that, right? Like, you know, I don't think I've ever had to really deal with too many hardships.
Well, one of my beliefs is we look at people that are in a place that we see as successful, and a success is multifaceted. But I think we look at people that are successful and we fail. Like, I believe, well, my newest philosophy is if I see someone that is 10 out of 10 successful, then I believe somewhere in some area there is a 10 out of 10 struggle that they are going through or have been through. I think no one goes smooth sailing and has a 10 out of 10 in something without, and I think about this in sport, I think anyone that has pushed themselves hard enough to have amazing success in sport, world champions, this and that. We look at them, we think they're amazing. I'm like, what's driving that? Because in my opinion, in my experience, in some of the people that I know, there's always something somewhat of a pain or a heartache that is driving them forward in that way. So that's one thing. Well, I want to ask you, and this is the last thing I want to ask about the show, I want to ask you, is there anything that really profoundly changed in your thinking or that you learned about yourself having gone through that, in the middle of that, or what you saw, or how you, like, is there anything that stuck with you?
Oh, I mean, a lot. Yeah. I mean, I'm really proud of myself and the way I participated in the documentary. I really set myself a goal to be really authentic and vulnerable and, you know, really kind of take the playful out in the opportunity that it was.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad I did that. There were some things that I'm a little disappointed they didn't make as part of the documentary. Like there was a couple of times where I kind of went toe to toe with Catherine, so there were the two hosts, Indira and Catherine. And they were, you know, kind of when they had us in the warehouse asking us questions. And I mean, Catherine, you know, she's a social researcher and, you know, probably knows 100 times more about the issue than I do, right? But she also seemed fairly set on her stance regarding public housing. And I just didn't agree with it. I, like I said, you know, not to say that that wouldn't impact things, but for me, it felt a little bit superficial or a little bit of a Band-Aid solution, you know, and you know, I mean, I kind of encapsulated in something that I said at the time, and I've kind of continued repeating this because I like the way that it sounds, but I think it really encapsulated what I was talking about as well. And it was like basically talking about how the issue is not houselessness.
Yep.
The issue is homelessness.
Yes.
And there's something that separates a house from a home. And that's the issue. That's the issue, like the human component to it. You know, how we, you know, like I said, how we, you know, relate and treat with each other. I mean, look, I think the biggest thing is it's changed how I interact with homeless people since. And it doesn't mean that's always the case, but nowadays, you know, often when I do see a homeless person, if I've got time, I'll stop and I'll do nothing more than chat with them for a few minutes, you know, like, hey man, how you going? You know, what's your name? I'm Tim. I'll ask them where they're sleeping. I'll ask them when the last time they had a shower. Cause I feel like I now know a few things to talk to them about. Like I'll ask, hey, you know, hey, keeping off the gear, you know, or, you know, looking after yourself. I mean, once again,
That is everything, isn't it?
Well, I don't know. So maybe a little controversial here, right? But so you may remember in the documentary, I think in the last episode, the last couple of days, they gave us $15 a day, saying that that's what a homeless person had to spend each day. You know, you got to choose what you spent it on. And I think it was a Friday, the first day that it happened, and I kind of waited all day trying to figure out what I was going to spend it on. And at the end of the day, I figured out what I was going to do. And I went to the local pub and I had like a pint of beer and some tacos. And, you know, I guess for me it was, you know, I mean, even now, right, if I have a tough week, I might drink a couple of glasses of wine or a couple of beers on the weekend watching the footy or, you know, kind of escape.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't want to escape more than someone who's living on the streets or in one of those dingy, freaking horrible boarding houses?
Mm.
You know, and who the fuck am I to judge them?
Yeah.
You know, like, who the fuck am I? Seriously, like, to begrudge them, you know, wanting to get a bit drunk and have a bottle of wine. Okay, look, doing it every day is not going to be productive. You know, once again, I'm not judging too much because I can get it, you know. But, you know, the other thing that I discovered that I wasn't aware of prior to doing it was that most of the alcohol and drug issues that homeless people deal with develop after they end up on the streets, not before.
I think the saddest thing is when you realize that homelessness is in part their choice, because whatever they're coming from is worse than if being homeless on the street of Melbourne is more comfortable than whatever they've just come from, how terrifying.
Yeah. Like, and also not forgetting as well that it's only a small percentage of homeless people that live on the streets. Like I think it's like 5% or something like that. You know, many are sleeping in their cars, many are couch surfing, you know, many are in transitional temporary accommodation. You know, I mean, okay, yeah, look, weather and cold makes it tough, right? But, you know, Tiff, if you had to go and find somewhere, you know, under a bridge to sleep tonight, you could. That's not so much the issue. It's how are you going to deal with no one paying any fucking attention to you, no one giving a shit about you, no one, you know, it just reminds me, I think on the third or fourth day, I can remember, you know, because I'm kind of traipsing around during the day, going places and the camera crew's following you. I remember I had a day where I was a little bit loopy. Like I was like talking to the camera. Like I was one of those crazy homeless people talking to themselves, except I had a camera to talk into. But that's the isolation.
Yeah. Early when I started boxing, I remember, and I had this guy on my podcast, and I'd go to the boxing gym. We were doing the boxing challenge. So it was 8-week boxing challenge. This guy would be at the boxing gym up the back, long hair in a ponytail. Literally, I remember walking in going, he was really friendly, softly spoken, warm-hearted guy. But it was like, a guy looks like he's homeless, right? Little did I know, he was. At that time, he'd had a bad break. He'd had a bad situation with a partner who had taken all his money, got him into a whole bunch of trouble. So he'd lost his home. He had two kids. He slept in the car with those kids. He still funded them to go to a private school. He would catch the train 2 hours to get to the gym to come and do this boxing challenge. He couldn't do all of the training till the end, and he had to beg them, please let me fight. You don't understand what this means. He couldn't do all the training and won the fight. And right now he's got a clothing label and he puts kids through these boxing things and he funds them and he gets people like myself and a whole bunch of other trainers to do a session with him a week so they get exposed to the best trainers. And he's so generous, and you just think, you just have no idea what someone's going through, you know?
Yeah.
No idea.
You know, and it's something that I think I've become a little bit more sensitive to since the documentary as well. And, you know, maybe it's also been becoming a father, but I've become a lot more sensitive to the struggles of men. And, you know, I don't for one second want to invalidate any of the struggles that women are dealing with right now. You know, I mean, domestic violence, woman being killed every week, that just should not be happening, right? But we can also keep the thing separate, right? It doesn't have to be a competition, you know? Like, I just think so many men just suffer in silence. Yeah. And, you know, it's our job to, well, you know, or society says, or we think it's our job to kind of, you know, just battle on, just keep, you know, like pushing and pushing and pushing. And no man, and no wonder, you know, what is it? 7 or 8 men every day kill themselves, you know? It's just so tragic. You know, I mean, I've been in low points too, you know, and it's just, you know, life can turn around, and it can turn around big time. It's just, I guess, so sad that people make such a decision that's so final, you know?
Yeah, yeah. But I guess when you kind of, I mean, watching you on that show, and then as I'm watching the show and watching what it literally does to you over those days, you know, you go from someone with this idea and this perception of what it's going to be like, and I go, look at how that's crushing this person. And this person knows that this is a 10-day experience. This person's got a camera crew, so they're not even alone. Like, this is temporary, and they're protected. So there's stuff that obviously you're still, your fight or flight, you're still, all those things still kick in, but there's still that story in your head that, you know, 8 more nights, 7 more nights, oh, this is, I feel a bit nervous, but this guy can't stab me because the film crew's here, you know? So,
funnily enough, where it got probably scary was I actually felt safer on the streets than I did. I mean, I felt a little bit scared in the crisis accommodation, which was probably the second episode. But that was, you know, you're now in an environment where there's 54 men. They do have rules about alcohol and drugs, but, you know, it's not everyone necessarily follows the rules, and there are scuffles and things. And, I remember my first day there. You know, and I got there just before lunch. It's chow time kind of thing. It was like one of those prison movies, right? You kind of walk into the mess hall and you got your tray and the food goes on the tray and you turn around, you look around the room and it's like, where do I sit? There's this like, you know, table at the back that's on its own, and I'm like, all right, I'm going to go and sit there. And I take a few steps and this guy like kicks the chair out in front of me and he kicks the chair out in front of me and it kind of stops me and he goes, you the new guy? And I'm like, yeah. And he goes, sit down. And I was like, oh, okay. But, you know, but the, I guess the context was they had no idea. They just knew there was this film crew and this guy. They didn't know whether I was a journo, whether I was anything, right? And, of course, you know, like I said, you know, not a lot of people initially want to be on camera because this is, they're going through, you know, the toughest time of their life, right? Yeah. And, you know, and I just, within the first day, I think I made a statement to the guys, like in one of the rec rooms, and I was like, look, guys, I know, you know, I know I'm a tourist, right? The camera crew, they got to follow me no matter where I go. So you guys, you know, don't feel comfortable with me around, please just tell me. I'll go somewhere else and they have to follow me. And then kind of like, you know, once again, it feels like the, one of the jail movies, right? But later that night, one of the older guys who was kind of, I guess, someone that they, you know, was kind of looked up to or had been there longer than the others, you know, went into his room and he came back out and he offered me a cigarette. And, you know, I didn't kind of, I was almost a bit like, hey, why are you even offering me a cigarette, you know? But I realized not long after that was his way of sending a message to everyone. Because cigarettes are like, you don't give away cigarettes.
Wow. But
offering one to me as a way of saying, hey, Tim, I like, you're cool, man. Like, you know, I respect what you're doing. You know, that kind of thing, you know? And you know, then when I left there, they were complaining. Like, guys didn't want me to go. They wanted me to stay. Like, you know, some, many of them had kind of taken me in. And that was really great. But then going to the transitional accommodation where there's no support, no supervision, no, that was hairy. That's where you saw me barricading myself in one of the rooms at night.
Yeah, I remember that. I'm not surprised. That's terrifying. You know, the first book I ever read in Melbourne, or that I remember reading, wasn't much of a book reader, but I read this biography by Kate Holden, and because I lived in St Kilda at the time and my friends had read it and said, this is a good book, read it. Kate Holden was a girl who ended up with a heroin addiction, ended up as a sex worker on the street and then in establishments, and then went to rehab and got out of rehab and then went back to rehab. And reading that, knowing it was a real human, and the streets that she was talking about was here where we lived, I remember driving down Carlisle Street in St Kilda after that and looking at a homeless person and for the first time going, I wonder what your story is.
Mm.
And even that really graphic, like she was quite graphic, a lot of the stuff that she wrote about, but she, the first time she became a sex worker, she was walking home with, there was this old man with groceries, and asked her, and she helped him across the road, helped him carry his groceries, and then she went into his house, and it, you know, it was just, but the way she wrote that book was amazing, and the way that she wrote about that experience took you from the judgmental of what it is to actually how she described it in her mind. It was like, oh wow, like I've just seen life through a different lens. I actually need to stop judging everything because life is not the same for every person.
It was incredible. Yeah. And once there's that kind of human connection, it's hard to separate that again, you know?
Yeah.
And like, you know, I mean, I'm, like I said, I keep saying, you know, how fortunate, you know, we both are, right? But, you know, I've got some friends that work, do some pretty harrowing jobs. You know, one friend of mine, he's the guy that gets called when kids try and take their life. He's the guy that, you know, runs programs and kind of turns them around and does some amazing stuff. But, you know, some of the stories he shares with me, like, you know, mothers pimping out their 12-year-old daughters, you know, like, and I want to be careful because it's really easy to go like, what a fucking asshole of a person that must be, right? But, you know, once again, if you can pause for a second, and, you know, I'm not at all condoning, of course, and not at all removing the responsibility she has, but what must that woman have been through in her life?
Exactly.
That's where things have gotten to.
Exactly. And the thing is, when we've been through something, we develop these coping mechanisms that shut down and change systems, right? So one of mine was this dissociation. So when I stepped in the boxing ring, comfortable for me, right? Because, and I was dissociated from what was happening in there. So wasn't terrifying, couldn't feel the punches, didn't emotionally react to the conflict in there because I developed a system that processed reality 3 days later when it was safe to do so.
Yeah, wow.
And over time, I realized that. And there's still stuff I look at now, like my ability to trust people is ludicrous.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been under the microscope only for the last 6 months because I had a Dr. Bill Saunders had an episode with me on this show, which halfway through turned into a therapy session accidentally because I always wheel my shit out like it is, you know, which is great because I've got the world's best therapist, so, you know, I'm saving thousands. But turned into this quite invasive therapy session, and like he explained from what I've been, he's like, most people have a trust dial, you know, it goes up and it goes down. He goes, you have a trust switch, it goes off and it goes on. And I've watched that since he said that. I've watched and felt that and gone, that it literally does. That it is on or it is off. And so now I'm learning to manage my reactions to things because I understand that there can be a switch in my trust for a situation or a person.
Yeah.
And I just have to navigate that differently. It's really interesting. And you go, well, that's a small thing. Imagine the people that have been through enormous traumas that are really shutting down their system and changing. So our behavior is driven by our neurochemistry and that's driven by things that we're not controlling with our mind, right? So we have adrenaline and norepinephrine and dopamine and serotonin, all these things going in and out of our brains because of the circumstances around us, because of the story we tell, because of the things we've been through. And then those things make us react or choose certain behaviors. So they're just getting all messed up in people. So,
and I think the other thing as well is that we got to always remember what your brain's goal is. So everything is run by your brain.
Yeah.
And your brain has, well, it technically has two goals. Now, once again, I'm not the world's leading therapist, right? So I could be wrong, but
no, oh, that's why I got you on.
Two things: to survive and to reproduce,
yeah.
And that is it.
Yeah.
You know, and it will achieve. I mean, and you know, the functionality of the brain we understand is obviously storing everything, but primarily what your brain does is predicts the future. And then it predetermines what is the best course of action to have you survive that moment. Right. So, you know, like the way they've been able to measure this now is just if you're given a choice to select something, say the salt or the pepper, right? Before you've consciously chosen, your brain has already fired all the neural pathways to generate the thoughts, feelings, emotional states, mental states to have you pick what it wants you to pick.
Yep.
And it will pick what it thinks is going to give you the best chance of survival.
Yeah.
You know, so this is where we struggle with our brain. And, you know, this might not be entirely correct, but, you know, your brain, it feels like it's got running a successful automation.
Yeah.
You know, all right, don't deal with the trauma now. Let's disassociate so that we can process it in 3 days' time because that's the safe way to survive this moment. Not realizing that, of course, there's that part. I mean, surviving life is one goal, right? But we don't really have to worry about it being eaten by saber-toothed tigers like we used to, right? It's now, it's about living a fulfilling, satisfying life. You know, and survival doesn't exist there. You know, in fact, you've got to risk your survival for that. You've got to live life on the skinny branches. You've got to be willing to get hurt. You've got to be willing to fail. You've got to be willing to look stupid. So it's this constant, this is why, you know, we're in this constant battle with our fight or flight, our biology.
Yeah.
You know, biology is always pulling us one way, but, you know, there's what we really want in life, because we have got the autonomy now, you know, we're not threatened, our survival's not threatened every day. There's other things we want. We want love and satisfaction, trust and fulfilling relationships.
And there's that weird thing, you know, in if you follow a lot of psychology shit like me, you'll know what I'm talking about, but where we find ourselves in the familiar situation. So for me, the boxing ring felt familiar, right? There was familiarity in that fight or flight fucking little zone. People that tend to be in violent relationships and leave them and end up in a violent relationship and leave it, right? No one's consciously going, oh, that guy's going to turn out to be violent, I'll choose him. They're like subconscious, their nervous system. Person. Yeah, right.
The person, because that partner's not really a threat.
Exactly.
Because that, okay, yeah, they might bash them, right? And not minimizing that at all, of course, right? But that's not the brain's real threat. The brain's real threat is not being loved or not being accepted or not being, you know, and so this, you know, once again, we see this happen a lot is people choose the partners they think they deserve.
Mm.
You know, because that partner's really not a not a real threat.
Mm.
You know, it's like, you know, it's why people self-sabotage. It's why people don't go for the jobs that they really want. It's why we don't start the businesses we've always wanted to start. It's why we don't pursue, you know, like, you know, I mean, you know, there goes the life that we wanted to live when we were eight, right? And then we mature. Basically, we make a decision that all these things aren't possible.
Yeah.
You know, and it's, that's how we go through life. Like, you know, you, I don't know, you in year five, teacher asks a question, your arm shoots up, miss, you know, and then you answer and you get it wrong and everyone laughs. And then you're like, oh, hang on, don't do that.
Yeah.
You know, little less possibility of life. And then you know, you put your heart out there and you tell your crush that you're in love with them and they reject you. And you're like, don't ever do that again. I'm just not someone who expresses my emotions.
Yeah.
I'm just someone who's I'm comfortable with conflict, or I'm, you know, I'm independent, or I'm motivated, or I'm analytical. And it's like all these possibilities have been shut down, and that we end up becoming a certain way.
Mm.
That's really not who we are.
Mm.
You know, it's like almost that's a quote about, you know, when Michelangelo sculpted David. You know, there's a quote that says that all he did was chipped away everything that wasn't David.
Yes, yes.
You know, like being able to chip away all those things, that these patterns or these beliefs or these, you know, and get back to the real you kind of thing.
Oh, this is my favourite topic. I love it. I feel like you're about to have a baby in a week.
Yeah.
And on top of being busy with that, you're going to be busy dealing with an influx of emails from me going, can you come back on? Can you come back on? Can you come back on? Because I have loved chatting with you about all this stuff. And I want to get you back on sometime to talk about the kind of business stuff you do and all of that finance and success stuff. It's really cool.
Yeah, well, what a lot of people know, apart from the finance and success stuff, that I actually, you know, part of that, you know, when I stopped working, I had about 4 or 5 years where I did a lot of self-discovery and, you know, I did a lot of reading and learning and, you know, identifying some mentors. And I ended up leading some programs for one of the top companies when it comes to things like personal and professional development.
Oh.
And it's all around being able to distinguish essentially these kind of past-based beliefs that limit us and being able to complete them and you know, free ourselves from them.
I love it.
Mm.
I love it. Ah. Oh. So good. I'm so glad I pestered you in the first place.
Thank you so much.
Hey, how can people, have you got things that you want people to follow? You got business stuff, well, socials?
Yeah, look, I mean, on the socials, you can pretty much get me anywhere at TimGuestAU, and my business is Infinite Wealth. Give us a Google, follow us on, I don't know, all the things, Facebook, YouTube, blah, blah, blah. We're everywhere, right? So just search either Infinite Wealth or Tim Guest. And yeah, I'd love anyone to follow me. That'd be great.
Well, I'm going to start paying particular attention and see if you can't make me quite wealthy, Tim Guest.
We haven't even started with that stuff, have we?
Ooh, I can't wait.
Awesome.
Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot, Tiff.
Thanks for tuning in to Roll With The Punches with me, your host, Tiffany Cook. Don't forget to subscribe, and if you're an Apple Podcast user, drop us a rating and review. Because if I know what content is landing best with you, then I'll make sure I keep hitting the mark. To stay up to date with all of my movements, upcoming events, training and mentoring programs, or to book me to speak at your event, then head over to my website at www.rollwiththepunches.com.au and be sure to connect with me on all the usual social platforms. Thanks for joining us.